My name is Raj Raghunathan. I'm 55 years old. Today's date is the 12th of November, 2022. I'm at the McComb School of Business in Austin, Texas. And the name of my interview partner is Kennedy Stubblefield. And he is currently a student in my class, and he was a student in a previous class as well.
My name is Kennedy Stubblefield. I am 22 years old. Today is November 12th, 2022. I am in the McComb School of Business in Austin, Texas, and fortunate to be interviewing my professor, Raj Raghunathan, who is currently a professor of mine this semester, as well as two semesters ago. So glad to be with you, Raj. Why don't we start from the very beginning? Can you tell me a bit about where you grew up?
I grew up all over India. My father was in the Indian Railways, which meant that he had a transferable job. And so right from birth until I went to college, we kept moving. In fact, the longest that we stayed in any one place was 3 years. So moved to, I think, 7 different locations by the time I was 18, went to college, spent 4 years there in college undergrad. That was the longest that I spent in any one place up to that point. And then I got my MBA in another city. And then I worked for a couple of years, and then I came to the U.S. But grew up all over India.
So I imagine moving around growing up, you attended multiple different schools. Can you tell me a bit about what you were like as a student growing up?
One of my earliest report cards, we used to get these things called report cards back in India at the end of the school year. Maybe you did in the U.S. too. It mentioned that I was very reserved and I need to open up, which I find very surprising to, you know, to see that now, because I'm like probably the most extroverted person that I know. I guess I was like that. I know that I was later on in my life very stimulation seeking. That is that I wanted to experience new things, put myself in unfamiliar situations, because that kind of made me feel more alive. And that's continued to this day. Growing up in India, all over India, because I, like I said, grew, you know, went to 7 different places by the time I was 18. So I just was exposed to a lot of different cultures. And so I think also because of that, the kind of travel bug bit me. So I've always had a little bit of that wanderlust. So I would say that that's a big part of my personality too, and perhaps added to my stimulation-seeking nature. And right from when I can remember, I was always very fun-loving. I think that was very important for me to have fun, to be happy, and to have a good time. I wasn't necessarily studious at all. I ended up managing to get into good universities and all that. I'm really thankful for that. So I do think that I managed to somehow do that. But my first priority was to have fun. So we used to play a lot of cricket, for example. We used to have a lot of fun and games at parties and things like that. So that's my memory of growing up.
So can you tell me a bit about, like, as you moved to different schools growing up and seeking this kind of fun nature of life, like, what was your aspirations with what you wanted to be growing up? Maybe how did that evolve as you continued to travel to different schools and different places?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't remember now what my answer might have been to a question like, what do you want to be when you grow up? That was posed to me maybe when I was 5 years old, 6 years old. This is a very standard question that kids get asked around the world, I feel, and that's true in India too. And I might have had a standard answer like a pilot or whatever. But later on, I do remember very distinctly that I wanted to have a similar job to that my dad had. My dad was in the Indian Railways. He was a civil engineer. He used to build bridges. And you got to travel all over India as part of the job, and you got to live in these big bungalows built by the British. You know, the British occupied India for a long time, right? And these were, like, really fancy. They were, like, huge, up to 10,000 square feet, you know, huge mansions. And you got a lot of, like, help. You had maids and cooks and drivers and, you know, caretakers. So all of that was given by the government of India, and it seemed like a very nice life to have. You got to travel, you got a lot of help, you got to live in big mansions, and you essentially could do a lot of other things outside of work too, because you had a lot of free time, it looked like. So I loved reading, and so that would have been something that I would have done. So growing up, I wanted to emulate my dad's success, so to speak, or like be, you know, have a job similar to that my dad had. And then I don't know. I think that I went to the engineering school, and even at that time, I could have probably gone into the Indian Railways, but then the MBA bug bit me. A lot of my colleagues and everybody was saying, oh, you know, if you want to really make big money, then you get an MBA, right? Mm-hmm. I said, okay, you know, let's do that. And then once I got my MBA, I just ended up basically putting myself on some kind of a conveyor belt, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, you like automatically go through the interview process and everything, and then you land a job. And I got a job in advertising. It was then that one of my friends sent me a photograph from the United States. I was working for an advertising agency. And one of the photographs was from New Orleans, from Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of imagine what the photographs depicted, beads and so on. And the other photograph was of a Pink Floyd concert in mm-hmm. Dallas. And behind the Pink Floyd concert photograph, he had written, "Now I can die in peace." Meaning to say that he's achieved everything that he wanted to achieve in his life. So you can imagine how big like of a fan he was and I was of Pink Floyd. And once I saw that, I really knew that I had to get out of India. You know, I wanted to come to the United States to get the PhD, because that was more or less the only way in which I could afford to get out of India, because PhD pays you a stipend, mm-hmm. and we are a middle-class family, right? We didn't really have a lot of money for me to be able to travel here and pursue a degree and pay the tuition all on my own, right? So, in fact, I needed some money to live here. You know, forget about paying the tuition. I needed some basic, you know, level of money to sustain myself here. And so the PhD program seemed appropriate. So, you know, it's kind of not a recommended thing. Now that I'm a professor, I wouldn't tell people that, you know, hey, you know, just apply for a PhD because it pays you a stipend and then, you know, go back, right? I mean, really, PhD is like a serious thing, and mm-hmm. you have to devote a lot of time and attention and effort. But I'm so happy that I did that. And now, of course, I'm a professor. So I went all the way from wanting to be an officer in the Indian Railways to maybe a couple of other things in between to now ending up being a professor. Yeah.
Wow.
Can I ask, when did you come to begin your PhD program, or when did you get those postcards from your friend?
I got the postcard from my friend in 1993, end of 93, I want to say, and maybe actually beginning of 93, and then I ended up applying to the PhD program. Yeah, now I remember. I ended up applying to the PhD program in summer, fall of 93, and I ended up coming to the U.S. in 1994.
And then can you remind me again when you ended up at UT in particular?
UT, I ended up in 2000, mm-hmm. 2000, 6 years after I came to the United States. So it took me 6 years to finish my PhD. And typically, at that time, it used to take between 4 and 5 years. So I took 1 year longer. Mm-hmm. And that's because I joined the University of Arizona for my PhD program. And then the department there broke up and people left the department. And everybody basically told me to leave as well. Or not everybody. I mean, most people told me that the department had shrunk to the extent where my training would be affected and my prospects for getting a good job would be affected. And it was one of those things that at that time was like devastating for me, because, you know, coming to get a PhD and then the department breaks up. Now I have to kind of like find a new home again. But in retrospect, it was one of the best things that happened to me, because I came in here and I got good grades at the University of Arizona, which is where I joined for my PhD program. And so I was able to reapply to schools because the department there broke up. And because mm-hmm. of my grades, which were good, I got admitted into NYU, which is a more highly ranked school. And I also got a sample living in New York, which is awesome. I think that everybody needs to have a little bit of time in New York. It's just such a vibrant city and so much happening and everything. I think living there for your whole life is probably going to get you more, like, too stressed or something, stressed out. But spending a little bit of time there does open up your eyes.
Absolutely. So you mentioned earlier about your dad and your aspirations to potentially follow his career to some extent. Can you talk a bit about some of your role models growing up and how they've shaped the person you've become today?
That's a really good point, a good question, a good insight, Kennedy. My dad definitely was a role model for a very, very long time, not just because he had the job that I thought that I would really like as well, but I also liked his personality. I think he was just very funny and brave to me. I mean, I think everybody's dad is kind of brave in, you know, the mm-hmm. kids' eyes perhaps, but it definitely was true for me as well. And he gave me a lot of freedom. So any topic under the sun was open to discussion in the house. And even though we were a kind of a conservative family, we could talk about, you know, sex or drugs or, you know, what have you. And there's no limits, basically. And I really liked that atmosphere growing up. He was definitely a role model. And then later on, I think it shifted to one of the not shifted. I mean, I think that, you know, you can have multiple role models, right? So my dad definitely continued to be a role model. But this actor, his name is Amitabh Bachchan. He's one of the most famous actors from around the world, I think, in fact, if you just count up the number of people who know somebody, right? Because India is such a populated country. So he would rank up pretty much up there in terms of popularity, even to this day, even though he's 80 years old now. And then a cricketer by the name of Kapil Dev. So these were my role models growing up. And then later on it shifted when I started to become really interested in the topic of happiness and subjective well-being, as it's called in the research. So people who work in the area became my role models, including this professor called Ed Diener, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. But also people who epitomized happiness. And, you know, so people like the Dalai Lama and people who epitomized seeking happiness for other people and freedom for other people, like Nelson Mandela, Mahatma Gandhi, and philosophers. There's a philosopher by the name of Jiddu Krishnamurti from India. I'm a big fan of his. David Hume in, you know, Western philosophy. And also a bunch of contemporaries now that I really, really like a lot, including Sam Harris, for example. So I don't really think that I have, like, idols or, you know, role models, but there are people who kind of have inspired me, I suppose. You know, that's what I think the question is trying to get at. And for sure, all of these people have inspired me. And also, to add to that, researchers like Barbara Fredrickson, Sonia Lyubomirsky, people who work in the area of happiness. Yeah, all of these people are inspirational for me.
So in 1993, you get a postcard from a friend, and you decide to pack your bags and get your PhD at the University of Arizona, end up at NYU, and ultimately UT. Can you walk me through the path of how you ended up at UT here and as a professor full-time?
Yeah, so when you get a PhD, right, the aim is that you end up as a professor. Most people aspire to be able to get to be a professor, and that certainly was true for me. And one of my I had two dissertation co-chairs, and one of my co-chairs basically said that, look, the way that you look at the job market is this. He said, ask yourself, would you rather be a professor at a particular university or would you rather be jobless? And if you'd rather be a professor at the university than be jobless, then just apply to that school, right? And so it was a pretty low bar, basically. And so I applied to about 120 schools. And I got interview offers from a lot of schools out of those, like 33 or 34 schools, you know, about a third of them. And UT Austin actually hadn't called me for an interview until the very last day. And in fact, I was a little bit disappointed because obviously UT is a good school. And coincidentally, this friend that had sent me those postcards was getting his PhD, or gotten his PhD from UT Austin. And so UT Austin, or Austin, was the very first city that I landed in the United States, because that's where I had a friend. Even though I was going to Arizona, I first came here and I spent 3 or 4 days before I flew to Arizona. And so I was disappointed that they hadn't called me for an interview, but it came about on the very last possible day. And so I obviously made room for it. You know, that's how I ended up here. And to your question, you know, why did I choose? Obviously, it's a good school, right? And it's also in Austin, which is an awesome city. Even back then, I knew that it was an awesome city because I'd visited and people were, anyway, talking about Austin as a good place. You know, music was big, and music has always been big in my life. In Austin, music is big, right? And also, it's in the kind of warm belt, so to speak. You know, and I'm from India, right, where it's warm, and I prefer it to be, I prefer warm climate to cold, if I had to choose one. So there's just a lot of reasons why UT Austin was up there. And so I chose to apply to UT Austin. And then of the jobs that I got, I actually got quite a few jobs. I got like 8 jobs from these 33 universities. You know, so the way it works is you apply to universities, and then they call you for an interview, and then they call you for a second interview. So I got a second interview from, I think, 10 or 11 schools out of the 33. And then I eventually got a job in 8 of them. And there was a little bit of dilemma or, you know, difficulty in deciding which of these schools to come to. Eventually, it came down to, I think, Dartmouth and UT Austin and University of Toronto and potentially Hong Kong because I had a significant other at that time from there. INSEAD is in Paris. But anyway, so it's a little bit of difficulty in figuring out exactly where I wanted to come, but then I just decided to come to here, for a variety of reasons. But one of the big ones was because of, I kind of like looked into my heart, so to speak, and asked myself, how did I feel when I was interviewing there? Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what were the feelings? Rather than thinking through, okay, which is the best university for me, which pays the highest money, or where my career prospects are going to be the best, and so on and so forth, I just looked into how I felt. And I felt most at home in Austin, and so I decided to come here.
Mm. So keep on that same note of, like, feeling at home in Austin. At what moment when you chose Macombs and when you began your 10-year studying here and teaching here, did you feel that you truly belonged here on the 40 acres?
Okay, that's a good question. And so I kind of partly answered it, right? Right off the bat, I did feel a sense of belonging. And I can't really kind of put my finger on exactly why that is. I think that there was certainly an element of warmth among the faculty here. They seemed very welcoming. They rolled out the red carpet, and they made me feel special, right? Which I think that, anyway, most of the schools attempt to do that because, you know, they kind of identified you as a potential candidate to be a colleague. And at that point, you know, it's a kind of dominant strategy to roll out the red carpet, right? So every school attempted to do it. But it just felt like the way in which it was done here seemed authentic. And I do think it was authentic now that I've been here for a long time, right? 22 years since I joined. So I just felt this was the right place for me. And also, I think that to some extent, beyond the feelings, a little bit of calculations came into the picture as well. I did want to be in the United States. So I did get into the University of Toronto, for example, or INSEAD in Paris and Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. So those were tempting as well for a variety of reasons. But U.S. is where a lot of the research is, even to this day. But certainly back then, this was ground zero for, you know, if you wanted to be an academic and scholar. So that was important. And also, Austin was the right size in terms of being a city, because I did know I was like 33 when I came here. So right size in terms of raising a family. You know, New York is great when you're single, but if you want to raise a family, I think it gets to be tough, in my opinion. So there's a variety of other factors that are more cognitive, if you will, or functional factors that I kind of layered on top of the hedonic emotional attachment that I had to Austin. So those were the reasons.
Absolutely. So taking a step back, maybe looking at the flip side of things, what are some of the challenges that you remember facing, maybe when you first began UT, and then maybe over the later course of your time here as well?
Yeah, so I think this speaks more to my personality, perhaps, than to how my life has unfolded. But in general, I don't tend to look back on life as much. So I have to really kind of like think through not just the challenges part of it, but what were the high points kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. I don't tend to spend a whole lot of time in the past. But that said, the very first couple of months in Austin were very tough. I do remember that because I was coming to Austin from a city that I'd grown to love and had a social circle, obviously, there. I also had a significant other there who was just going to go to Hong Kong at that point. And so I was going to be away from all of that. And Austin was hot. I mean, in July, it was like a volcano. And so weather-wise, it wasn't very welcoming either. And I literally did not know anyone, right? I mean, except my colleagues who were also kind of traveling at that point in time, a lot of them. So I felt kind of alone. And subsequently, I've learned that, moving to a new place is one of the most stressful things. This is not just my experience wasn't unique, in other words. But I did not know that at that point in time. And so, you know, later on, I tell myself and I tell other people who are moving that, you know, don't make any hasty decisions in the first 2 months, maybe even up to 6 months after you move, because those are tough, right? Let everything settle down, and then whatever you feel after it is more genuine to that place or, you know, to the validity of the move. Anyway, so that was tough. The first couple of months were definitely tough. The passing away of a colleague, I would definitely say that that was the toughest that I've experienced, perhaps even in life, I would say, because I've been very lucky in terms of having my family, my parents are alive, you know, like extended family, even a lot of the close relatives, all that has worked out well. But this friend of mine, my next door neighbor, in fact, a colleague, and it was so sudden as well, you know, he just fell down a flight of stairs and hemorrhaged, basically. So it was just unfortunate, sudden, and we had so many plans. He had come to India, had gone to the Netherlands with him. He was Dutch. So it just felt as if a set of, you know, things that were going to give me a lot of positive experiences and utility, you know, put it in kind of like economic terms, I suppose, was just suddenly taken away, yanked away from me, you know. There's no closure, there's no opportunity to say goodbye, nothing, just, you know, gone. So that was extremely challenging. And to this day, you know, I think of him and I think of the good times we had, and I'm grateful for all those good times that we had. But I also feel a sense of, just negative feelings that, you know, we didn't get to spend more time together. So that was a very, very challenging time for me, for sure. Mm.
So digging a bit deeper on the challenges you've faced and how they've affected the person you've become, what were some of the coping mechanisms that you had? And maybe how do you think that you grew as a person through facing these challenges?
Yeah, so, you know, as you know, Kennedy, very well, I teach a class on happiness here. In fact, you're a student in the class. And so I tend to look at everything that happens in my life from the lens of, okay, how do I deal with this situation in order to emerge from it in the most productive manner possible? And a big part of that is to maintain my sense of emotional equanimity and also learn from experiences in a way that makes me a better human being, more skilled or more compassionate and so on. And so with the passing of somebody that is really, really close to you, there is a moment in which, or even not just a moment, there's just a period which can last quite a long time in which, you know, there's a cloud hanging over you and you're not able to think straight. And that's not the time in which, you know, you're really, you know, I don't think that I did, at least, and I think it's totally appropriate to be this way, that, you know, I wanted to learn from it, or, you know, wanted to kind of like manage my emotions or anything of that sort. Way in which I coped with all of, you know, that challenge in particular, I mean, the earlier challenge which I talked about, which is, you know, feeling bad or feeling isolated after moving to Austin, I think, you know, obviously it's much easier to deal with that. And I think that one of the ways in which I dealt with it was to, you know, try to make new friends and attempt to go out and, you know, and so on and so forth, which, you know, worked for me. And within a couple of months, I'd bounce back. But with my friend, I think it was just a combination of things that helped me cope with it. And one of those is a kind of a philosophical view of what life is. And, you know, I think most of the religious perspectives on what life is and what death is and all that do help you to cope with it. So if you look at the more kind of Abrahamic traditions of, you know, Judaism or Christianity or Islam, there is the concept of heaven and hell. And, you know, so good people go to heaven, and we obviously think of our close friends and family as being good people. And so we feel good that, you know, they're in heaven and having a good life there, afterlife there, what have you. I was born a Hindu, I suppose it, that's a big reason for this. But even otherwise, I think that in my thinking of things, I tend to think that the reincarnation ideology makes a little more sense to me. And so to me, you know, the energy that was my friend is still alive and is somewhere, maybe reborn or maybe, you know, transmutating or whatever from one form to the other. And so I just want to send good vibes to that energy. And, you know, hopefully I get some good vibes from that energy back. And so that's my way of coping with it. So I guess you could summarize it as saying that I just feel like he's gone in a bodily form, but not really dead, you know? And I think that thought helps me reconcile this craziness and, you know, this unfortunate thing and what seemed like a very unfair thing in my own head. And that allows me to cope. Anyway, long answer to your question, but hopefully it makes some sense.
Totally. You know, I told you the other day when we were passing that I think you have the best job ever. And I think one of the components of that is that the work that you do and the studies that you like do as well, like actually manifest a lot of real world ramifications that you can use and leverage as you did with this event. Can you walk me through how you actually ended up studying happiness? Like what was the path like from working a communications job all the way to happiness at UT?
Yeah, it's a great question, Kennedy. And yeah, I do have a story for this because it is an unusual thing to be teaching happiness in a business school. When I used to tell people, now it happens less frequently, but back in the day when I first started teaching it about 13 years ago, first couple of years when I used to tell people I teach a course on happiness at the business school, they would do a bit of a double take. You know, happiness in a business school? How does it fit, right? So the story is actually pretty long and somewhat complicated, but the short version is this, right? I was always interested in happiness ever since I was a child. I just didn't think that happiness is something that you could study or teach or make money out of. You know, it was a interest of mine, even a passion, but I didn't necessarily think that it would pay the bills or anything like that. So I kind of like went the engineering route and then the MBA and then the PhD and then became a professor and everything. I was teaching consumer behavior. And then we have this wonderful thing that happens if you're sufficiently research productive and people like you enough and you've taught well, which is that you get tenure, right? So tenure, for those who don't know, is that you don't get fired after you get tenure. Okay, so it gives you this freedom to explore things that are of deeper interest to you without worrying about job security. That's the original idea, you know, knowledge for knowledge's sake. And the idea is that when people do that, eventually good things come out of it that benefit humanity. And I do think that there is a lot of evidence that that's true. And so I'm a big fan of the tenure system. And I do think that I took full advantage of it in the sense that in 2006 or 7 is when I got tenure. And I then realized that, oh, you know, I really was interested in happiness, always been interested in happiness. I better do something about it, right? And I also noticed, coincidentally at that time, that a lot of the people that I knew from my own MBA days who were very successful weren't necessarily happy. So it seemed like happiness is the ultimate goal, that everybody seeks it, everybody wants a meaningful, fulfilling life. And we all assume that if you get a good degree and a good job and everything, then happiness follows. But here I saw examples of a lot of people that had achieved a lot of kind of worldly success, but weren't necessarily happy. And I thought to myself, maybe the same thing is happening with my MBA students, right? Maybe we give them these tools and skill sets and everything to, you know, get a good career going and, you know, manage market share and make a lot of money and be famous, successful, etc. But if they aren't happy at the end of the day, then are we as educators really fulfilling our role in terms of helping them achieve life's big objectives? So I remember this. This happened like 15 years ago now. 2007, I'd taken a bunch of MBA students to India as part of a course called Global Connections, and it was the last night, and we were traveling back to the United States the next day. And we were having a party in Gorai Beach near Mumbai. There's a bonfire, everything, you know. And so I turned around and asked these students of mine, if I were to teach a class on happiness, guys, would you be interested in taking it? And almost in unison, every single person's hand went up and said, yes, professor, we'd love to take it. We'd definitely take it. Now, everyone was a couple of beers down, and so I wasn't sure if they were, you know, genuinely enthusiastic about it or if it was their beer speaking. But anyway, I took it as evidence that there's at least some interest in the topic of happiness. And so I ended up putting this course together, and now it's kind of like, you know, rest is history kind of a thing, in the sense that I've continued to teach it for 15 years, and not just that, I've written a book on it, I have a couple of online courses on it, one of which has become really, really popular on Coursera, etc. So yeah, so to come back to your question, which was, I'm kind of like lost track of the question. What was it again, Kennedy? Can you remind?
Yeah, so how did you end up in the niche of happiness?
Right.
And maybe even give me a bit of an overview of the courses you teach today.
Okay. Yeah, so I was answering your question. I just thought that was slightly different from... Oh, yeah, so I ended up teaching a course on happiness because of, you know, my interest in happiness as a child, and then tenure, and my recognition that people weren't necessarily happy even if they had conventional success. And so I put this course together, and now, you know, I've been very fortunate to be able to continue to teach it for so long. And as I've taught it over the 15 years, the interest in happiness has only become even bigger around the world, which further validates my decision to teach it, or my desire to teach it. And it seems almost as if, like, everyone else has also jumped on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. So with regard to other courses, my home department is marketing. And I love the field because it's at the kind of intersection of so many different kind of more fundamental fields, so to speak, you know, psychology and economics and sociology and business and finance and so on. And so, you know, it taps into human nature. It taps into being practical and applicable and relevant to the real world rather than just like, you know, academic knowledge. And so I love that aspect of it. So I teach consumer behavior. I teach design thinking, which I absolutely love. And I also have taught this global connections course, which involves taking students to other countries and exposing them to the culture and the marketing practices of other countries and so on. Mm.
So earlier you mentioned you don't often take the time to kind of pause and truly reflect on the journey you've had so far. I'm going to challenge you a bit here. If you would, if you had the opportunity to go back and give yourself a younger version of yourself advice for the journey that you know you would be soon to face, what would you tell a younger Raj?
Mm. Yeah, that's a good question. I think that I would say something that almost seems a little bit cliched, you know, which is that I would tell my younger self, you know, chill, everything's going to work out. Mm-hmm. Everything's going to be great. You're going to have a really good time. No need to be anxious about how the future is going to unfold, because I think a lot of us, especially when we are young, and I don't know, you seem like a particularly well put together and sorted kind of a person, Kennedy, but most people tend to be worried about, you know, what's my future going to hold? Am I going to get a good job? And, you know, am I going to be able to, you know, make ends meet and so on? And so I tell my younger self, don't worry about all that. Just chill. Everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be better than great, in fact. And so, you know, enjoy yourself. That's what I would say.
Mm, totally. Okay, so if you're up for it, I would like to shift the focus to McCombs. Speaking of that, is there a particular space or maybe a spot on campus that you particularly connect with either now or in the past?
Yeah, I do. Actually, there's maybe four or five spaces that I really, really connect with. One of those is fortunately my office. I really love my office, even though it's less organized than I would like it to be. And my intention is my future self is going to be more organized. I also love a couple of spots just outside of the McCombs School of Business, out in the open. One is between the McCombs School of Business on the south, what is it, east side of McCombs and Gregory Gym. Mm-hmm. There is a little, I don't know, sitting spot, like almost like a ledge on which my colleagues and I used to sit. And nowadays, after COVID, you know, people don't seem to be coming in as much, so it's not happened in the last 3 or 4 years, but we sit there and just have a tea and catch up and, you know, take a break. I love that spot. I think all-time favorite spot, though, would have to be the steam room inside the faculty locker at the gym. I just love that space. I go work out, and it's a little treat that I give to myself. I go and sit in the steam room for about 10 minutes or so. I feel like all the toxins come out of me, and I do a mini meditation session in there, a mindfulness session in there. And I absolutely love it. That's my favorite spot.
Mm. And then keeping on the same note of McCombs, are there any teachers or students that come to mind as people that have had a particularly influential impact on the person you've become?
Yeah, I obviously, you know, they say that, you know, best way to learn about something is to teach it, right? Mm. But even beyond it, I think the students are excellent teachers because the students here, especially the undergrads, I would say, of course the MBAs too, but especially the undergrads are really, really enthusiastic and bright and curious. And the questions that they ask are really smart. And so you have to kind of think through a topic to understand, you know, and answer the question. And so they've been a great source of learning. And beyond it, my colleagues have been just wonderful, really wonderful. I can name so many of them. My current chair, his name is Andy Gershoff. He's an awesome guy. And I've learned so much from him. My own batchmate, her name is Raji Srinivasan. So I love her and everything that she's done. My senior colleagues, including Vijay Mahajan and Wayne Hoyer and Bob Peterson and Susan Broniarchik, Lee McAllister, so many of them. And they've all been really, really amazing and influential. And that's all within my department and beyond my department. The deans, they've allowed me to teach a class on happiness. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't get better than that. So yeah, lots of people.
I have a feeling we touched on a bit of the answer here. But what would you say from your experience truly makes Macomb's different than any other school?
Yeah, so one thing that makes it truly different is that it's a school located in one of the best cities in the world. Of course, I'm biased, but you know, most people would say that too if they visit Austin. That's amazing. Also, you're right that I did touch upon it a little bit. You know, in which school would you get the freedom to teach a class on happiness, right? And this is almost 15 years ago that I brought it up, that I wanted to teach a class on happiness. And they could have very well turned around and told me that, look, happiness is totally disconnected from business. Why would, you know, anybody want to take a class on happiness? And therefore, we're going to decline this request. But that's not what they did, right? They said, oh, Raj, you're really interested in teaching a class on happiness? Go ahead, do it, right? And let's kind of see how this unfolds. And that's what happened. I mean, I started teaching in 2009. And from the get-go, there's been a huge interest in terms of from the students on the topic of happiness. And so I've continued to teach it and not just continue to teach it here. Because I began teaching it, it allowed me to build up the content for the course. And that enabled me to then start blogging for Psychology Today. And then I came out of the book and I, you know, like I said, I have a couple of online courses and so on. It's just gone from strength to strength. And so that's, I think, maybe not unique in the sense that only Macombs would have allowed it, but it is certainly I think only a minority of schools would have given professors the freedom to teach something that was so out of the mainstream in terms of a topic. Yeah.
Yeah. So the adage of UT, what starts here changes the world. Obviously, we're both very familiar with that. How would you say that you applied what you've learned here over the course of your tenure at UT, you've taken and applied to the real world?
Yeah. So, you know, for us, the real world is the teaching world. Mm-hmm. And I've been fortunate enough to teach a variety of courses that are all real world relevant. And I think that the course on happiness is perhaps the most real world relevant. And I mentioned this earlier, the best way to learn about a topic is to teach it. And it's definitely given me a lot of insights into how I should lead my life. So because I teach a class on happiness, there is an element of walking the talk, right? I mean, you can't just tell your students that here are things that you do in order to lead a happier life. There's some onus on you to kind of also do those things, right? And so I lead a healthier lifestyle. As a result, I've worked on my attitude toward life. You know, I think that's perhaps the most important determinant of happiness after your basic needs are met, is the narrative that you have inside your head about what the world is like, right? Happiness is an inside job. I've been increasingly more kind and generous, I would like to believe, and I hope that other people around me think that too. I have a greater level of internal control over my own feelings. I believe that I pay more attention to what my intrinsic motivations are and my interests are, and less attention to extrinsic rewards like fame and money and power, etc. So it's been transformational for me at a kind of a inside out level. And, you know, to me, that's as good as it gets in terms of real world applicability.
Totally. So taking a bit of a step back here, maybe a bit more reflective once again, what do you think it takes from your experience, from your perspective, to be successful in business? And why do you think you ultimately have garnered the success that you have?
So here, you know, I think that it's important to define success, right? I think that if you have access to basic needs and beyond even a little bit, you know, then I think that to me, success comes from doing things that you like, having a sense of calmness and positivity about you, being nice to other people around you, your friends and family in particular. That to me is success. And I think that because I was given the opportunity to teach a class like happiness, it allowed me to, A, kind of come up with this definition of success, which I think is important. Plus, it also allowed me to realize what the ingredients of this kind of a success are. And thankfully, I have a job that is not just like paying me enough to meet my basic needs. It's actually like really good, you know, in terms of the access to resources that I have. So, I think that having... Okay, let me just rewind a little bit here. I do think that it's very, very important to have clarity on what makes you happy. I think that if you have that clarity, I think that the universe does some wonderful things in terms of opening up doors that allow you to live the life that makes you happy. And I think that that's been perhaps the single biggest determinant of my success, is having the clarity and not letting go of it. Right from when I was younger, I told you about the photograph that got sent, right? Mm-hmm. So I knew that I wanted to come to the United States after those photographs, rather than continue to work in India. And I think that clarity of what makes you happy and then going for it is perhaps the single biggest determinant of success. Mm-hmm.
So on a final note, looking forward for the next 10, 20, 30 years, how do you imagine that the future of the worlds that you inhabit in business, in happiness, in McCombs are going to continue to evolve?
Yeah, so there's lots of challenges that the world faces, obviously, you know, climate change and income inequality and so on and so forth. The thing that holds a lot of promise for me is the interest that happiness has garnered across a variety of different stakeholders, not just lay people, but also business people, and in particular the government. A lot of governments have started to measure happiness alongside GDP. And so that's a very positive sign. And I think that that's going to continue to evolve because ultimately everybody wants to lead a happy life. I don't think that we can escape that truth. And so I'm really looking forward to contributing, not just as a person, but as a team at the University of Texas of professors to the emergence of happiness as an important topic.
Absolutely. Well, Raj, thank you for an incredible conversation and an amazing opportunity. And on behalf of all of your students, past and present, thank you so much for all the work that you've done.
Thank you very much, Kennedy. Really appreciate it. Thank you.